Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Deuteronomy chapter 14. Moses is giving his second discourse, his speech to the people of Israel on the plains of Moab as they are preparing to cross the Jordan River and enter into the promised land under Joshua. Our context is this. In the previous chapter, Deuteronomy 13, Moses inveighed against false prophets and idolaters, telling the people, you want to die? Be an idolater. You want to be blessed? Follow Yahweh. So we start now in Deuteronomy chapter 14, verses 1 and 2. You are sons of the Lord your God. Do not cut yourselves or make a bald spot on your head on behalf of the dead, for you are a holy people belonging to the Lord your God. The Lord has chosen you to be his own possession out of all the peoples on the face of the earth. Now, what is this big deal about the Israelites not cutting themselves? This is obviously referring to a pagan religious custom. Let's look at 1 Kings 18:28. They shouted loudly and cut themselves with knives and spears according to their custom until blood gushed over them. Leviticus 19:28. You are not to make gashes on your bodies for the dead or put tattoo marks on yourselves. I am Yahweh. Now here's some options as to why pagans did this. It could have been option number one, a funeral custom. John Gill says they tore their garments, but their flesh in several parts of their bodies and their mouths, cheeks, breast. Jeremiah 16:6 says this, both great and small will die in this land without burial. No lament will be made for them, nor will anyone cut himself or shave his head for them. So you see, that's obviously pagan customs. Notice now there's a psychological problem where young girls cut themselves because they feel bad about themselves. I think if you really want to get philosophical about this, why do pagans cut themselves? Well, because the devil came to kill, steal, and destroy. The body is good. The devil says, no, the body is bad. Let's deface it. Let's mark it up. Now, also making a bald spot on the head, that's probably also a pagan custom also that the Israelites were to avoid. The NIV Study Bible translates this as, do not shave the front of your heads. Exactly what that is probably not clear. The NIV Study Bible said this was the practice of mourners in Canaan at funerals. Jameson Fawcett Brown says this, quote, the making a large bare space between the eyebrows was another heathen custom in honor of the dead. Probably taking the front of your hair where your bangs are, if you have bangs, and then just shaving the front part of it. This pagan practice is mentioned in Leviticus 19:27. You are not to cut off the hair at the sides of your head or mar the edge of your beard. The hair at the sides of your head, I'm assuming, is your sideburns. And the edge of your beard is very close to your sideburns. I think this might be where the Orthodox Jews get the idea of letting those little curlicue pieces of hair fall down the sides of their head. The Holman Christian Study Bible puts in a note that the head there is your forehead. So it's basically shaving a bald spot on your forehead, not on the center top of your skull. Now the Israelites are said in verse 2 to be holy people. You are a holy people belonging to the Lord your God. This is in contrast, of course, to the pagans referred to in verse 1 who are cutting their hair and their skin. Deuteronomy 7:6 says, for you are a holy people belonging to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be his own possession out of all the peoples on the face of the earth. Holy means separated from the world and dedicated to God or consecrated to God. Now, Deuteronomy 14 verses 3 through 20 list a bunch of clean and unclean animals. And I've already covered these clean and unclean animals in great detail in my discussion on Leviticus 11, where most of these food laws are. Deuteronomy 14 closely parallels Leviticus 11:10. So I'm not going to go through all the animals that you may eat, the ox, the sheep, the goat, the deer, the gazelle, the roe deer, the wild goat, the ibex, the antelope, and the mountain sheep. Let me mention ibex. I ran into an ibex one time. I was at a place called Rimmon, I think it's called. It's a huge crater in the southern desert, the Negev of Israel. And I don't know if the tour guide said that they actually filmed scenes in science fiction movies that look like total desolation, like Mars, basically. That's what it reminded me of, was Mars. I don't know whether he told me that. I think he did, or it might be I just thought this would be a great place to film such a scene. But anyway, it was an incredible place. And as I was sitting there looking out over the crater that was, I don't know, miles and miles and miles and miles wide, all of a sudden this little animal comes up to me, and he kind of looked like a stunted goat, a little tiny miniature goat with long horns. And I said, what in the world is this thing? I never had seen or heard of such a thing. Again, it gave me the idea I was in outer space or another planet tour guide said that was an ibex. Cute little thing. But anyway, you could eat him if you caught him. So we move now to Deuteronomy 14, verse 21. You're not to eat any carcass. You may give it to a temporary resident living within your gates, and he may eat it, or you may sell it to a foreigner. For you are a holy people belonging to the Lord your God. You must not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. Now, why could the Israelites not eat a carcass? Well, it's because the blood could not be drained out of a carcass properly. And, of course, eating blood was an absolute no-no in the law because the life is in the blood. As we'll read in our famous scripture in Leviticus 17:11, for the life of a creature is in the blood, and I have appointed it to you to make atonement on the altar for your lives, since it is the lifeblood that makes atonement. There has to be life given for life. There has to be a death of an animal or the death of a sacrifice to atone for the death that we should be experiencing. Of course, Jesus is that ultimate sacrifice. Well, blood symbolizes that life, and so it was separate. It was holy, and you couldn't eat it because that would profane it. Here are some other scriptures in the Old Testament law and also in Genesis showing the prohibition against eating blood. Deuteronomy 12:16, but you must not eat the blood. Pour it on the ground like water. Some people say they were just supposed to pour it on the ground. Other people say they were supposed to pour it on the ground and cover it. I suspect it's cover it in addition to just merely pouring it. Deuteronomy 12:24, do not eat blood. Pour it on the ground like water. Genesis 9:4, however, you must not eat meat with its life blood in it. Now, what could you do with a carcass then if you couldn't eat it? Well, it says you may give it to a temporary resident living within your gates. Now, this temporary resident does not refer to a proselyte to Judaism, as John Gill points out. A proselyte was just like any other Jew. He couldn't eat blood. Now, remember, there was two types of proselytes. Proselyte of the gate, that's a Gentile who wanted to remain a Gentile. He wouldn't be circumcised, but he wanted to let Israel mediate for them. Basically, a proselyte of the gate is someone who agreed to obey basic morality but not be circumcised. And then proselytes of righteousness are people who wanted to be full-on Jews. They had to be circumcised and to do everything else a Jew would do. But then there was a different sort of non-Jew in the population. These were aliens. Heathens, idolaters, they might be somebody doing business with the Israelites. They might just be passing through on a journey. Well, you could sell a carcass to an alien because the aliens weren't a member of God's chosen people and they weren't involved in the tabernacle sacrifices of blood. Now, verse 21 has this famous prohibition in here. You must not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. And I remember for years wondering, why in the world is that in the law? What is the big deal? Well, again, remember, if you're going to interpret this, you have to look at the culture, the context of the law. Now, the NIV Study Bible and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown give what I think is the context. This was a Canaanite pagan ritual that the Israelites were not supposed to participate in. Here's a quote from Adam Clark, who also agrees. He says this, Dr. Cudworth is supposed to have given it its true meaning by quoting a manuscript comment of a Karaite Jew, which he met with, on this passage. It was a custom of the ancient heathens, when they had gathered in all their fruits, to take a kid and boil it in the milk of its dam, the dam is the mother, and then in a magical way to go about and besprinkle with it all their trees and fields, gardens and orchards, thinking by these means to make them fruitful, that they might bring forth more abundantly in the following year. So basically Clark is saying the pagans would take the kid, nurse the mother, get some milk from the mother, and then boil the kid in that milk, and then sprinkle the broth on plants to make them grow better. Jameson Fawcett and Brown agrees with this. They say, quote, a prohibition against imitating the superstitious rites of the idolaters in Egypt, who at the end of their harvest seethed a kid in its mother's milk and sprinkled the broth as a magical charm on their gardens and fields to render them more productive the following season. Well, I think that's the reason. Now, some people say, come up with another reason why the law prohibited the boiling of a kid in his mother's milk is to show that the Israelites were not to be cruel to animals, as John Gill suggests. Adam Clark says this, quote, thou shalt do nothing that may have any tendency to blunt thy moral feelings or teach thee hardness of heart. Even human nature shudders at the thought of causing the mother to lend her milk to seed the flesh of her young one. We need go no farther for the delicate, tender, humane, and impressive meaning of this precept. Well, Adam Clark, if he's living today, might apply for membership in PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, who think that human beings, that animals have souls and can be tried in court like human beings, or can bring lawsuits because they're just like humans. To be honest with you, I don't see what's cruel about this. A kid being boiled wouldn't care whose milk he's being boiled in. If you're so worried about cruelty to animals, why not say you don't boil a kid at all in anybody's milk, much less his mother's milk? Well, I mention that because a lot of other people think that that's the reason. And I don't think it's the reason. I think it's because the pagans were doing this for pagan reasons, and that's why the Israelites were not to boil a kid in their mother's milk. Now, let's move on to Deuteronomy chapter 14, verses 22 through 27, and this is the famous passage on the tithe, which is incredibly complicated. Let me read it. Verses 22 through 27, each year you are to set aside a tenth of all the produce grown in your fields. You are to eat a tenth of your grain, new wine, and oil, and the firstborn of your herd and flock, in the presence of Yahweh your God at the place where he chooses to have his name dwell, so that you will always learn to fear the Lord your God. Let me just stop right here. Eat a tenth. So this is referring to eating at the tabernacle, just like the peace offerings were eaten, portions of the peace offerings were eaten at the tabernacle. Also, you got the firstborns are eaten at the tabernacle. So in general, there's three times that Israelites ate at the tabernacle: peace offerings, tenths, and firstborns. Verse 24, but if the distance is too great for you to carry it, since the place where Yahweh your God chooses to put his name is too far away from you, that's Jerusalem, and since the Lord your God has blessed you, then exchange it for money. Take the money in your hand and go to the place the Lord your God chooses. You may spend the money on anything you want: cattle, sheep, wine, beer, or anything you desire. You are to feast there in the presence of the Lord your God and rejoice with your family. Do not neglect the Levite within your gates, since he has no portion or inheritance among you. All right, before I start going through the multitudinous options of how the tithing system worked in Old Testament Israel, let's take care of a few details here. First, notice the practical permission that allowed the Israelites to exchange their firstborns and their tithes for money, so it would be easier to carry the money down to Jerusalem than it would be to carry the animals. Notice that when they got down there, they're taking their tithes and they're having a party, a feast. So that illustrates the principle of joyous giving. Giving is always done in the context of joy. In the New Testament, is God loves a cheerful giver. Notice that the Israelites could take the money that they made from selling their tithes and firstborn. They could spend it on various cattle and also beer. Now, I like that because, you know, I lived in the South, and the church in the South has had a thing about beer. Now, I don't like beer personally. I like wine, but I don't like beer. Just a taste thing. But it just bugs me. Well, all my life I've heard Christians, and down here it's the Southern Baptists, let's face it, the Southern Baptists who say, beer is a sin. Well, I'll give you $5 trillion, $5 quadrillion. I'll write a check for it right now to anybody who thinks they can prove in the scripture that drinking beer is wrong. Well, right here, they're having a festival with beer spent with tithe money. Ooh, how unholy can you get, these Israelites? Now, that word beer is translated differently. That's the Holman Christian Study Bible. The NIV calls it other fermented drink. The NASB calls it strong drink, and so does the KJV. So beer is kind of mild. It might be something stronger than beer because it says strong drink. But at any rate, whatever it is, that's an interesting verse for teetotalers to deal with. Now, I will say this. Today, I think people have reacted against the way cultural Christians like Southern Baptists have jumped on beer so much that now you got these young millennial-type Christians and they're drinking the hardest liquor they can find. I wouldn't be surprised if they're pouring vodka, having vodka in their communion service because they're free. We don't want to be tied down by all these cultural traditions. Folks, you know, the Bible does have to say something about being drunk, and you don't. It's just taking it too far. It's reactions against bad things usually produce other bad things. But at any rate, that's a rabbit trail. One other point I want to make before we get into how the tithing system worked is verse 27, which says, "You shall not neglect the Levite within your gates." Now, the Levites are going to participate in all this tithing. This is not the first time Moses said this, by the way. He said it in a previous, I forgot where, a couple of chapters ago. I don't have the sites with me, but this is not the first time. Why is he so concerned that the Israelites not neglect the Levites? Well, because they don't have any land, no portion or inheritance. Now, in an agricultural society, land is wealth. You don't have land, you are poor. Now, the Levites did have cities, and they had some pasture lands around the cities, but basically they didn't have large tracts of land. They had no tribal inheritance because they were the priests. So they were the servants of the tabernacle. And so the Israelites had to support them. And Moses said, don't you forget that. They are dependent on you. All right, now that we've gotten the easy stuff out of the way, let's look at some options on how the tithing system worked. Now, there's all kinds of dispute on this. I'm going to give you several possibilities. I am not going to try to say which one is right or which one is wrong because I don't have the slightest idea. Nobody knows. But I am going to go through some options to show you how complicated the issue is and also to show you that, hey, we're under the law of the tithes. How many times have you heard preachers say your tithe, give your tithes and your offerings? That's in the Old Testament. And every time I hear that, I'm going to say, okay, Mr. Preacher, depending on the tithe, please go back to the Old Testament here and tell me exactly how Christians are supposed to do the tithe since we're under the tithe. And you're quoting Malachi all the time. Malachi was under the law, so you want us to be under the law. So you tell me how you calculate the tithe. I'll give you $6 trillion if you can give it to me clearly and show me how a Christian is under that. We're not under the law of Moses. I thought the book of Hebrews sort of said that. And the tithe is never mentioned in the church age. It's mentioned when Jesus was still on earth before the church was formed. In other words, when the Mosaic law was still in effect, sure, that's mentioned in the New Testament. But once the church gets started, you don't see one mention of a tithe. You do see about giving. Paul was very concerned about that Jerusalem poor tithe, and the other, he had two tithes he collected money for. So he was concerned about the poor saints in Jerusalem, and he talked about giving cheerfully, but there's no mention of a tithe. Well, anyway, let's look at some options. Here's the NIV Study Bible. This is how they say it was done annually. The first tithe is taken to the central sanctuary. The people would take a tithe of all their wealth, take it down to the central sanctuary, and they'd distribute it to the Levites. Now, while they were down there, the Levites would have a feast with them, and the Israelites and the Levites would consume a part of this first tithe in an initial festival. Now, most of the first tithe, of course, would be for the Levite support, and that would be the greatest portion, but there was some of the portion that was used for having a feast. Now, the Levites, having gotten their tithe from the people of Israel, then they would tithe their tithe to the priest. So that tithe of the tithe from the Levites to the priest would be the second tithe. Now, every third year, according to the NIV Study Bible, the people's tithe, the first tithe, was not taken down to the sanctuary, but was gathered in the towns of Israel and distributed to the Levites and the poor. The poor people shared in the Levites' tithes. Okay, well, that's reasonable. Let me give you another option. Adam Clark, well, first of all, the NIV Study's option would be that the tithe that's talked about here in Deuteronomy 14, you're set aside a tenth. That's the first tithe. First tithe goes down to the sanctuary, the Levites and the tithers, the people of Israel, celebrate and have a feast. And every third year, that first tithe gets eaten from in the towns and the sanctuaries. Well, let's look at how Adam Clark says it works. He says that the tithe being referred to in our passage here in Deuteronomy 14, 22 through 27 is the second tithe, the first tithe having already been given to the Levites, and then they are to take a tenth of that tenth, and they go down and they take it to the temple, and they give their tenth to the priest. Adam Clark quotes Nehemiah 10, 37 through 38 to back that up. We will bring a loaf from our first batch of dough to the priest at the storerooms of the house of our God. See, there's the idea the Levites are taking their first tithe that's given to them and tithing on that and taking the second tithe to the priest in the temple storerooms. We will also bring the first fruits of our grain offerings. A tenth of our land's produce belongs to the Levites, for the Levites are to collect the one-tenth offering in all our agricultural towns. A priest of Aaronic descent must accompany the Levites when they collect the tenth, and the Levites must take a tenth of this offering to the storerooms of the treasury in the house of our God. There's the tenth of the tenth. And Adam Clark says that the tenth of the tenth, the second tithe, is what's being referred to here in our passage. Now, here's Adam Clark's procedure. Annually, the first tithes are given to the Levites, who then tithe to the priest the second tithe, and then another tithe, the third tithe, was separated by the Israelites from the first tithe. They did that for the first and second year. The Israelites tithers ate this third tithe in a feast. So now we've got the tithe, the original corpus, the original amount of wealth that the Israelites have has been deducted by 10% to the Levites, and then another 10% is taken out of it to have a feast. So now we have a third tithe instead of having the second tithe being the same as the third tithe. And every third year after this third tithe, instead of being eaten at a feast, it was given to the Levites and the poor. Well, that's nice. All of these are reasonable. Here's another option I came up with through looking at a website called Grace Through Faith. The first tithe was from the Israelites to the priest and the Levites, not just to the Levites, but to the priest and the Levites. You know, most people say the first tithe goes to the Levites, and then the second tithe goes from the Levites to the priest. But Grace Through Faith here says it's the whole congregation gives to both the priest and the Levites. And then a second tithe is taken on the remaining 90% of the corpus of the Israelites' wealth, and all the people consume that in a feast. And then a third tithe is taken on the remaining 90%, and that third tithe is given to the poor. And, of course, some say that's done annually. Some say it's done on every 3 years. The every 3 years comes from the next two verses, which we'll read in just a minute. So the idea is that we have a third tithe for the poor. So this is kind of simple, really. The first tithe is for the Levites, the second tithe is for the priest, and the third tithe is for the poor. Well, let's look at some calculations. I love doing these calculations. According to this view, we have the first tithe is 100%. You take 10% of 100%, you got 90%. Then you take the second tithe for the priest, 10% of 90% is 0.099%. So you knock the 9% out from the original 90, from the 90%, and you got 81% of the corpus is remaining after the second tithe. So now you take 10% of the 81% that's left, and that gives you the third tithe size of being 72.9%. Well, the tithe is 8.1% leaving, and you take that out from the corpus that's remaining, which is 81% of the original. 81% minus 8.1% is 72.9% of the original wealth of the Israelites is left. I know you couldn't follow that, and I wouldn't be surprised if the math is wrong. This is total nonsense in trying to figure out how much of what is given when. This is the sort of stuff that could drive you crazy, that could be a great subject for a PhD dissertation, but I don't care because I am free from the law of the tithe. I just give. I pray to God, how do you want me to give my money? And that's not an easy thing, by the way. You can give your money to a lot of Christians and they'll rob you. I hate to say that, but I haven't been personally robbed several times. I'm a little sensitive about the subject. You need to be careful where you give the money, in addition to being careful about how much you give. And again, the Lord loves a cheerful giver, and what you sow, you reap. That's much more inducive, I think, to giving than you got to pay a tenth of your income. Do you tithe on the gross or the net? And you go through all these legalistic, ridiculous calculations so you can feel good that you've paid your taxes to God. Completely destroys the spirit of giving, in my humble opinion, this Old Testament law of the tithe, the storehouse doctrine that so many preachers say that we are supposed to be under. It was interesting. I was reviewing a manuscript of a friend of mine who's trying to publish a book, and he goes on and on about the tithe. Of course, that's a sore spot with me, so I, in reviewing the book, unloaded on that. And he says, did you have a bad personal experience? You know, that's what it all goes down to. You can't, whenever you're talking about the scriptures, if you get excited about something, well, you must have been hurt. I remember one time I was unloading on evangelical feminism, and this woman who was arguing with me, she sends an email to me and says, you must have been hurt in your childhood. Some woman must have hurt you. Don't you love to argue with people like that? I didn't even respond. It was the last I heard of her. But at any rate, this brother with the manuscript started doing some research because he noticed that he'd gotten a rise out of me, and turned out one of his teaching heroes, John MacArthur, agreed with me. I thought that was so nice because there's so few things I agree with John MacArthur. Well, apparently I agree with him on that too. I have learned from secondhand, so that's encouraging. We go now to Deuteronomy 14, verses 28 and 29. At the end of every third year, you shall bring out all the tithe of your produce in that year and shall deposit it in your town. Town as opposed to the central sanctuary. The Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance among you, and the alien, the orphan, and the widow who are in your town shall come and eat and be satisfied. So this is the poor tithe, in order that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hand which you do. Now that poor tithe, as I said before, it could either be the second tithe used for the Levites and the poor, or it could be only every 3 years used for the Levites. First 2 years, third year goes to the poor. I don't know. I don't care. But notice what I do care about is the last verse here, verse 29. Do all this, give your tithes to the poor, so that the Lord your God may bless you. Notice how blessing is associated with giving. The fundamental point to be taken from this audio on Deuteronomy chapter 14. And with that happy, happy, happy teaching, we are now ready to go to Deuteronomy 15, verses 1 through 23, the sabbatical year. I hope you stay tuned for that, and I hope you enjoy this audio.